Hello, hello, everybody. Welcome to class. Today, we will be talking about our love blueprint, where it comes from, the three phases of a relationship that every couple goes through, though not every couple makes it through the last phase. And then we will ultimately end on where our love blueprint comes from based on all of this information. So if you are going through today's presentation and having a lot of aha moments, that's great. That is the point of today's presentation. It is designed to help open your mind to pitfalls that you may have fallen into in the past with your relationships and other ways that if you are better equipped with this information moving forward, you can have more successful relationships in the future. So without further ado, I will get us going with our presentation and we will go from there. All right, let me make this full screen. I will make myself dining up beer. All right. So for our love blueprint, what is very important to keep in mind is that it is not your fault. So much of our lives are operating on our subconscious, what we think we know, and what we know, though we can't always put a pulse on that, our finger on the pulse, where this stems from. So our love blueprint is something that our parents, though well-meaning oftentimes, unintentionally gift us with, and it is something that we take with us into adulthood until we decide to change it and act upon it differently. So where our idea of love comes from, as I'm sure all of you know by now, if you've followed me, if you've taken the rest of this class, it's really important to analyze where that comes from. And I have a list, it's obviously a non-exhaustive list. There are many places that our idea of love comes from. Sometimes it comes from a place of experience, meaning we directly experienced whatever we define as love. And sometimes it comes from a place of neglect, meaning we never got to experience what we think we should have, or we were robbed of an opportunity to be able to be loved properly all the way from our infancy or childhood through adolescence and beyond. So our idea of love is more of an ethereal fantasy that we can't seem to get for ourselves, or that seems to be something that escapes us constantly. So our family of origin is the first place that we have our idea of love. There are different kinds of love. And this is something that if you're curious to learn more about, you can research Sternberg's triangular theory of love. I can also exit out and show you all. But our family of origin and the way that our parents had their relationship or did not have one also can have an impact on us, is the way that we have a template for what romantic love, or ideally, if your parents had some passionate love left and had a passionate marriage, what that kind of relationship looks like. And if they did not have that, or you did not have a two-parent household growing up where that was your model, whoever was around, and however separately, and this is the second part of it, how your parents loved you and interacted with you and what they said or didn't say and demonstrated what love was like, that becomes the baseline for your blueprint. And then the other families that you spent time around growing up are another part of this blueprint. So if you didn't have a loving a parents with a loving marriage, but you had a best friend or a classmate, their parents had a loving marriage, that might have been your template. Well, they're not like so-and-so's parents, or I wish my parents were more like this person's parents in a way. That is another part of where this template comes from. And then what we come at, aside from our family of origin and the friends that we grew up with, are the stories that we are told, whether that's implicitly or explicitly, about love, what it's supposed to be like and not supposed to be like. And this is where wires can get crossed. So if physical abuse, verbal abuse, or anything that was actually detrimental developmentally occurred in your household, or you were witness to it in media or TV that you watch growing up, or movies, that becomes associated maladaptively with what love is, rather than what love is not or should not be. So what was modeled to us is also implicit or explicit. And this is where media, movies and TV, the Disney princess, the knight in shining armor, the 90s rom-com where they have a meet cute and then they have a crescendo in the storyline and then they end up together. The only movie that's the exception is The Breakup, which I think is a great example, but mostly really happens in relationships. That all weighs on us, that imprints on us as we get older. And if it coincides with what we've been modeled or what we believe love should be like, then it strengthens as we get older and we keep searching for that template in addition to what our parents set us up with. Again, mostly subconsciously.
our own experiences as we're older and we are old enough to date and have our first relationship experiences are also where idea of love comes from. And the first relationship that you have is not necessarily your first love. It is your first attachment. And we've already talked about attachment in previous classes. Who you attach to for the first time and how you attach to them, is it securely, is it insecurely, sets the tone. Yes, attachment styles are flexible, as you'll remember. However, it sets the tone for what you assume and how you predict love will be for you, what you're worth, what you're not worth, etc. So when you look at all of these stacked together, we can start to get a really clear picture of what it is like and what it is not like to be loved or to love another person. So we either have a blueprint of what to do, or we have a blueprint of what not to do. And that is much of the time the clients that I work with are like, well, I know what I don't want. I'm very familiar with what I don't want. I just don't know how to get to what I do want. So when we look overall at the three phases of a relationship, separate from what our template is, this is where the proof is in the pudding, so to speak. It's a very key portion of where our love template comes from. And we'll start to see this playing out before I show you the real clincher at the end that most people are like, what? And that's my favorite part about this lecture, because it is really eye-opening and it will probably give you the ick and gross you out when you first realize it, but it's so true. And a lot of the old school psychoanalysts and therapists were pretty spot on when it comes to how closely our romantic and our parental relationships push on our internal buttons. Because obviously for other reasons, they're not the exact same kind of relationship, but your adult romantic experiences are the closest mirror you have to what your parent-child experience felt like in, again, not inappropriate ways. The first phase of love, also known as limerence, it's a very chemical reaction and it can last anywhere from 6 to about 15 months. We usually see couples shift at that 2-year mark, that make or break timeline. Will this work out? Will this not? The good news, romantic love is supposed to happen, and it is a sign that your chemical reactions are having a reaction to somebody that is of interest for some reason or another. It may not always be the healthiest partnership, but again, we are ideally coming at this from a framework of a securely attached, healthy relationship template. So in that pattern, a healthy pattern, in the healthy pattern, romantic love is the almost necessary first step of a relationship. The bad news, this is where people are like, ow, that hurts, and usually come into my office, is that romantic love is supposed to end. And if we've only ever idealized romantic love, it's going to be very difficult to think of anything else, or when shit gets real. And when you're actually in it and you're seeing your partner for their flaws, their strengths, you're talking about more future timelines, they're collapsing and becoming more in the now. Not everybody is desirous or ready and able to tackle and be in that part of love or the arc of a relationship. So little to no healing or growth is going to occur in this beginning phase. And mostly because nobody notices it. This is where so many things they do are so cute and endearing. And oh my gosh, it's so funny you do that and you do this. And the things that are pet peeves in the beginning that you look past are usually what ends up pissing you off as you move through these phases of a relationship, because it's not cute anymore. You don't have those chemicals drugging you and allowing you to see the person for who they're not. And the eclipsed version of them is this fantasy that you've built up, this ideal archetypal dream lover. The saying goes, after all, how much growth can occur if somebody is intoxicated? The spoiler alert is not much. So you don't really see many couples be working on things and changing. And if you are, I forget what movie it is, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, I think, where they're sitting in the therapist's office and he's like, 2 weeks, is that too soon for therapy? If you are noticing that you have a very truncated or collapsed timeline with your relationship and you're already hitting the shit's getting real phase of the relationship, which we'll talk about in just a moment, within the first few months, that is usually a sign that that person is not a good fit for you and that you're locked in this pattern of dysfunction. And the sooner that you can exit that pattern, the better for you and the other person long term. The power struggle is the next phase of the relationship, also cutely known as sleeping with the enemy. Even if intimacy has not reached that point, that is the ideology that we're going to work from. The drug has worn off. You are now in withdrawal. And the second phase begins. And this is where people are like, oh, that's what people were talking about this whole time. This is the power struggle. This is where the two of you have to reconcile that what you believed about the other person may or may not be true. They have flaws, just like you, if you have admitted those about yourself. They have quirks. They have things you'll like. They have things you won't like. You will also discover in this phase, if you haven't already, that there will be things you will or will not tolerate, meaning to interact with and still have respect for this person. So I will tolerate this in you. I will not tolerate this in you. And this is where if couples are crossing their own boundaries or not upholding their own standards and still staying with somebody, despite one of their core values being violated or their boundaries being violated or them not being a good fit in service of, but what if I get that fantasy person back? They're not coming back. The only way that that person would come back is if they broke up and dated somebody else and that person got to meet that version of the romantic love. It is a necessary phase for romantic love. We're not talking about the passion. It is a necessary phase for the delusional level of limerence to go away so that you can confront the real person in front of you. What a lot of couples don't realize is in this phase, when it feels like we're stepping in a minefield, those landmines were there long before your partner entered your life. Especially what is helpful is to think about, has this ever upset me before? Have I ever dealt with this before in a relationship? Is this the first time that I'm hearing of this? Is this the first time I've been triggered in this way? Likely the answer is no, if you're being honest with yourself. A lot of the minds that you'll come across that your partner will brush up against are a direct correlation with unmet needs and childhood wounds, which we, again, carry with us regardless of who we are partnered with until they are healed, or at least known. The potential to locate these landmines and disarm them is in the couple together, as well as in each individual. And some individual members of the relationship might be better bomb diffusers or on a better bomb squad or have had more experience than others. So there's something to be said for how familiar and how much practice a person has had in relationships and how that can correlate and translate into their skillful, or lack thereof, ability to diffuse these bombs that have been in your relationship. So to locate them, to be able to play minesweeper effectively, it is necessary that you brush up against them first. You have some sort of encounter, some sort of interaction in which the bomb not is detonated, but is activated. And this is almost sometimes a crunch time for partners where they're like, well, we got to figure it out. When you have a securely attached or securely functioning partner, the urgency does not look the same, or the acknowledgement does not look the same as for the potentially insecurely attached partner. When that bomb is detonated or is activated and it's boop, and then the beeping starts, obviously metaphorically, the other partner could be like, all right, let's take a breath. Let's take an inventory. Where did it start? Where did this? And the person who had the bomb stepped on, who's standing on it, is like, we got to figure this out right now. Oh, and they're freaking out. The goal is for that person to lean more into the insecurely attached partner, or to lean more into the securely attached partner and follow their lead. Just like a bomb squad person would be talking to you. Don't move there, move there, move. You want to follow each other's lead. And that also ensures trust and intimacy building in a relationship. So if you don't address these bombs, the power struggle becomes this continuous power struggle, shocking no one, of all these exploding minds, because you're not working together on detonating and diffusing them. And you can also, at this point, call in a partner or call in your partner to couples therapy with you to learn how to diffuse these bombs. We are experts metaphorically at diffusing landmines, or at least explaining to you, I don't think we can diffuse this landmine. How would you like to move forward in your relationship, given that this might be an entirely gridlocked issue? Your options are to try to work past it or choose to uncouple, depending on the situation. So you don't want to be wrapped up in this constant, I'm pushing on it, it's happening, but it's not happening, and I'm fighting, and then my needs going unmet. Getting locked in that conflict cycle really just ends up pouring salt in our childhood wounds. If we don't know that we have them, how could our partner know that we have them? And if we know that we have them, but we're not sharing vulnerably with our partner and allowing them to get to know us, the true definition of vulnerability is a susceptibility to injury. So if you've ever interacted with dogs or animals, if they don't trust you, if they do not have a good read on you, they will not show you their puppy belly. It is one of their most vulnerable parts, and they only do that with people that they have established trust with. So the way to vulnerability is not to immediately pour out everything about yourself or overshare too soon. It's to build trust, which is built on congruency. Does this person's words and actions match up time and time again, barring one or two flukes, because we're human and we all have error at times? Aside from that, it's really necessary for you to examine, how have I built trust with my partner? Can I be vulnerable at this phase, the power struggle, and share? It really activates me when I don't get a text message. I sat down and thought about it a while, and it really reminded me when I couldn't, you know, reach out to my parents growing up, or I was sick at school and nobody answered the phone when I called at the nurse's office. And I know it might sound silly, or you might not get it, and that's not your intention, because usually it's not your partner's intention. They didn't know hopefully you did not grow up in the same household or have the same childhood. Ooh. They don't know that about you. It's your job to teach them that and see what they do with it. Do they tend to it and hold it, or do they completely disregard it, or are they unable to deal with that and they pull out of their relationship? So if you are able to get past the power struggle, some couples break up at this phase, they just can't handle it. The next phase is the conscious relationship, where shit has gotten real, you know it, they know it, and you're choosing to keep in this relationship, the breakup or the breakthrough. Most couples break up just before the breakthrough. In my opinion, sometimes for good reason. Not every person is a good match. Sometimes we are a best fit for somebody up until a certain point, up until a certain lesson, up until a certain experience. We've learned all that we can from them, and it's time for that cycle to leave. It's time for that relationship to close. So one person's greatest need within the relationship is always met with the other person's greatest defense. That's often what we see. Usually, whether we know it or not, and this is where people are like, what? Why didn't I know this sooner? I think they should teach this in kindergarten. Well, maybe not that young. Usually we've specifically picked somebody who has trouble meeting our needs because of their own childhood wounds. Can I meet you in this way or not? And if not, is there something in me that I could work on to better meet this need? And I have a theory, a framework, if you will, that I work from, that if your partner requests a behavioral change from you that would better you in all areas, or it's something that you could take with you if you ever had to get into another relationship in the future, if it betters you and it would better you for the long term, ask yourself the cost-benefit analysis of making that change. What is it going to cost me to make it? What does it cost me to not make it? This is much different than being more how people describe as nitpicky, or you need to do this, you can't do this, you can, it's more, could you do more of this, rather than you can't do that. So it's expansive rather than limiting. And that's the key, is when we're making a conscious relationship, we are aware of our needs and wants in childhood, ideally, our partner's needs and wants in childhood, and we try to come to some collaborative decision. And if we are both doing that, many times we are able to pinpoint a specific relationship that either needs to be amped up or toned down a bit, or retired, as I word it, for both of you, because it's ineffective. And it would likely be ineffective regardless of the type of relationship you are in. If you have had a 0 to 25% success rate compared to another intervention or behavior you do that has 100% success rate, which one are you going to pick? My hope is the one that has the higher success rate. Yet we still try, and what if it works this time? And what if I can fix them? And what if they're... That comes from childhood and a delusion that we are going to be special enough to earn the love of our dream lover if we struggle with self-esteem. So in these situations that there is a true potential of the relationship existing, once we learn and contend to our own wounds, we learn to stretch beyond those defensive patterns, and they are no longer limitations. They're now points of awareness that if we brush up against them, we're like, wait a second, this is a sign that I need to grow. We come back and lean into our partner rather than nudging and breaking through the defensiveness. And now that's a wall that we've created in between ourselves and our partner. So everybody's favorite part, this is where our blueprint comes from. Now, if you are watching this, I would like you to get out a piece of paper. And I want you to take this line by line. So when you are rewatching this, close the window on this, because the PowerPoint will be full screen. Close the window and drag it so you're only seeing one line at a time. It's kind of tough for me to do that. So I will do my best at that. I might close this out and show you piece by piece. So then you have the aha moment at the end for the full picture. So I will do that right now, actually. I'm going to, before I show you, well, of course it won't let me do that. I want to, one moment. I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to open a blank PowerPoint. Wait a minute. Okay, yeah, I can actually just tell it to you. Okay, if it would work. Okay, so I'm going to stop the share and then I'll open it back up. So you want to get out a piece of paper. Here's what you're going to do. I want you to write down, and this is the easiest way for you to understand how your childhood impacts who you choose in your adulthood. I want you to write down the first, these are the first lines, and you'll get this as a handout. So don't worry, you don't have to make it perfect, but this is the aha part. So please watch this before you read the other part, because this is where the magic happens. This is key. If you have both parents in your life, the way I teach it is you can also pick any influential figure. So let's say an aunt raised you, a grandparent, anyone like that who had a large primary influence on the outcome of your life, they would go in this category. So you could do mom, dad, whoever your family system was. It could also be like mom, dad, grandpa, mom, dad, nanny, whoever had a primary influence. I want you to think of three negative characteristics of your partner or who you usually pick. Sorry. I want you to think of three negative characteristics of your parents or the person who had a primary influence on you. So this could be they were impatient, they were unkind, they didn't make time for me, they were always busy at work, whatever you want to word as negative traits. The next line, and take your time on this for each one. You'll see the handout, but there's certain quadrants for this. Then on the next line, I want you to think of three positive traits of those same people. They were loving. We had fun. They made me laugh. They have a sense of humor, whatever it might be. It could be related to you. It could be about them in general. And you can Google a list of personality traits. Where people struggle with this sometimes is we haven't reached the point that I'd like to teach called parents as people, which is the time in our life where we realize our parents are not omniscient, omnipotent people. They are only people. And they also have strengths and flaws, just like we do, just like our partner will. And this comes full circle in a moment. And we can evaluate them as both having good and bad parts, positive and negative, light and dark, shadow and light, however you want to describe it. When we reach that point where we can honestly take inventory of our parents, positive qualities and negative qualities, this is where relationships start to really thrive. If you are still so guarded and defended and defensive about your parents and your family, and you haven't yet realized their strengths and weaknesses, this exercise might be very difficult for you. So the key there. So first line, negative characteristics and traits. Second line, positive characteristics and traits. What did you long for as a child? And if you ever see this differently, you might see it worded differently. The three positive traits, three negative traits, in which case the last part of this would just be switched. So I'll explain that more at the end. So in this way, negative traits, positive traits, what did you long for as a child? This is not material objects like a pony, a treehouse, not that. Someone to play with me, someone to care about my inner world, someone to be there if I wasn't feeling well, someone to give a shit about my emotions. This is where you really want to challenge yourself and flex yourself on what that means for you specifically. And then the next line is, how did you want to feel as a child? Not how you felt, that's separate. How did you want to feel? Safe, cared for, nurtured, considered, anything that comes to mind, how you wanted to feel. And then the last line is how you responded to frustration. Did you slam doors? Did you storm out? Did you scream? Did you cry? Did you get really quiet and go negatively inward? Did you get sent to your room? So maybe that's a byproduct of you starting to try to deal with your frustration and you got shut down. Do you shun yourself? Do you become defensive? There's a huge list of possible reactions. So the way that this goes all together, and this is where I will restart the share, and most people are like, why did you show this to me? Because that's why you're taking the class. This is where you copy your answers. And again, this is everybody's most big aha moment. I am attracted to somebody who is, insert the negative traits of your parents. And this is, again, where I mentioned the flip. This is if you do negative, positive, positive, negative, you would just swap the A and B line. I want someone who is the negative traits, but I won't really fall in love unless they have. I want somebody who has the positive traits, but I won't really fall in love unless they have the negative traits. I'm attracted to somebody who is all the negative traits of your parents or primary caregivers, but I want them to be all of the positive traits that your primary caregivers were. So either way you slice it, you basically want, and your blueprint is what your parents both gave and didn't give you, their light and their shadow side, so that I can get what you longed for as a child, time, attention, consideration, etc. So, and feel, and this is where your emotion words come in, but I stop myself from getting the love I want by responding in adulthood the way that I responded to my childhood frustrations, because our romantic partnerships have the strength to pull us back to childhood. We aren't conscious often until we work on this. We are not conscious that we do this. We know that we do it, like we're aware of the behavior, but we don't really have a lot of awareness of where it comes from. And every time I do this and they get in a fight in this, then I shut down and cry and storm off. Do you remember if you ever did that when you were growing up, sibling, parent, et cetera? Oh yeah, I guess I did do that when I was growing up. If you analyze where these reactions and behaviors come from, you can learn to treat them as much as possible at the source. This is why it is so key to have an idea of where your specific blueprint comes from. And this is the culmination of the attachment style, the love temperament that you have, where your parents came from, your psychological development. This is the cherry on top of all of this work that it's so key to understand, because this is the gate. This is the key that unlocks the gate to you finding a true conscious love that you actually want to be with, that you want to interact with and have positive thoughts about. So with that, I will leave you to work on this workup. I will be filling in the rest of the information on the actual class itself. And if you have any questions, then you can send an email to my support staff, support@taliabombola.com. Until next time, when we have our next class. So I appreciate it, everyone. Thank you very much. And I hope that you have a great day or night, depending on when you're watching this.